Shall we do the quiz? Did anybody figure out what the real topic is? Now that Rabbi Geffen is gone, I can tell you that he makes me put it that way. I would have been more upfront, but he requires it to be, you know, yeah, sort of subtle, right? Well, in case you didn't get it, I don't want anybody to be here through false advertising. The topic is homosexuality. You got it? That's it? You know very well that you can't leave because that might create all sorts of... Right. Okay.
Guess what?
What I want to do is two things. First of all, I want to give you a little background as to how Torah sources will look at this topic. We'll look back at the activity and the condition. And then we'll talk about how we should look at people who have this condition. Oh, yes, and finally we'll take a look at the gay lobby arguments that homosexuality should be regarded as an equally valid lifestyle, and then I'll be finished and I'll be ready to take responses. Yeah. So first of all, Adam, the word Adam, it says in the Torah, is a name for male and female people together. Or for Adam and Chava, for the Golan and Chava, the first man and the first woman. By Yikra Shmom Adam, it says. He called their name Adam. It means that human refers to a male and a female in an appropriate relationship. That's what it means to be human. A man by himself and a woman by herself are not really human, not fully human. Human, Adam, refers to a male and a female in an appropriate relationship. Therefore, it says, a man shall desert his mother and father and mother, and cling to his wife, and it shall be one flesh. This doesn't refer to reproduction because animals do the same thing, and that verse is not said about animals. So it says the Ramban. Something unique happens in a human marriage. It doesn't happen in other animals. It doesn't happen in any other relationship. Now, can two people of the same sex truly love one another? The answer, of course, is yes. Parents love children of the same sex, and children love parents of the same sex. Siblings of the same sex love each other. Teachers can love children, students of the same sex, and students can love teachers of the same sex. Friends can love one another. Of course, people of the same sex can love one another. But every relationship has a different love. The love of parents for children is not the same as the love of siblings, which is not the same as the love of friends, which is not the same as the love of teachers and students. Every relationship has a different love. What the Torah is telling us here is that the love of husband and wife for one another is crucial for being truly human. Doesn't mean the other loves aren't important. Doesn't mean the other loves aren't genuine, true, valid. But this one is absolutely basic. Without this one, you're not truly human. For the others, it doesn't say anything like this. So, being homosexual means that you are cut out of this crucial development of the person spiritually, to achieve real humanity. That's the idea behind it. And the Torah classifies homosexual activity as illegal, a serious crime, among the most serious crimes, and therefore the condition is clearly an undesirable condition. Now, that's how we look at the activity and the condition. What about the people who have the condition and perform the actions? Here, the Torah has many rules that either reduce or eliminate a person's responsibility for his actions. This is across the board in Torah. The fact that an action is illegal tells me very little about how to look at the person who performs the action. The action can be totally wrong, and a very high crime, very serious crime, tells me nothing about how to look at the person who performs the crime. Let me give you some examples of rules in the Torah that reduce or eliminate a person's responsibility for his actions. Let's suppose that someone puts a gun to a Jew's head and says, "Bow to an idol." What is he supposed to do? He's supposed to die. There are three types of avarice that you're not allowed to do, even if you're threatened to be killed. You have to let yourself be killed. That's what the Torah says to do. Now you know, bowing to an idol is itself a capital crime. So let's imagine the following scenario. Someone puts a gun to the roommate's head and says, "Bow to the idol." Two witnesses are watching, Shimon and Levi. They say to the roommate, "Listen, bowing to an idol is forbidden by the Torah, and it's a capital crime. And we're here, we're watching you, we're warning you. Don't bow down." And let's suppose that Reuven can't face the challenge and bows to the idol. What happens now? What happens now is nothing. What happens now is nothing. Because he was threatened to be killed. And even though there are witnesses, and even though he's warned, and he can answer the warning, "I know, and I'm doing it anyway," he's not killed by the court. Because he was threatened to be killed. The court will not punish him at all. Furthermore, God's punishment for idol worship, which is kares, is not applied. He doesn't get kares for it. There's some discussion whether from God he'll get a lesser punishment. But in the human court he gets nothing, and from God he doesn't get kares. Why? Tell me something. Has he made his own decision to bow down to the idol? Is he exercising free will here? Yes, he is. After all, millions of people throughout history have decided to be killed. There is a decision here. Okay, there could be individuals who go into shock. I realize that. People could just sort of turn off, go into glaze, their eyes glaze over, and they, I don't know what I'm doing. Bang, their head goes down. Could be. But for the millions of people who decided to die, there must be others who decided to bow. You automatically lose your free will when somebody puts a gun to your head. So it could be that he chose to bow down to the idol. Still he's not punished. Why not? Because this is a very, very difficult test. To be willing to give up your life for Torah is a very difficult test. So, he failed. He failed a very difficult test. If you fail a very difficult test, is that a big failure or a little failure? You have to calculate now, boys and girls. If you fail a very, very difficult test, is that a big failure or a little failure?
Little.
It's a little failure. It was such a difficult test. That's why I failed. It was too difficult for me. Give me an easier test. The harder the test, the smaller the failure. So we say, this test was so difficult that we don't hold you fully responsible, and indeed, the level of responsibility goes down very much. The level of responsibility is very small. Even though the crime is a gigantic crime, we're talking about idol worship now. Even so, there'll be no punishment. Because he was under threat of his life. So this shows you that when you look at the person performing the crime, that's not enough. That doesn't tell you very much. You have to know why he performed it. You have to know what his inner struggle was. The harder the inner struggle, the less the crime. Here's another example. Rav Dessler considers a person who was brought up in a community of thieves. These people live in the hills, and they attack the roads. When people go through, they hold them up and take their money. Highway thieves. Now imagine that these people have their community in the hills, and they teach their children that stealing is the way the world runs. My wife has a book. We used to have a book called The Professional Thief. I interviewed this guy in the penitentiary. And this guy said like this, everybody steals. Everybody steals. White-collar workers use the telephones and use the company premises and the company car against the rules. Taxi cab drivers don't turn on their meters. Blue-collar workers steal materials from the building site. Politicians? I never talk about that. Right? They all steal. And everybody else cheats out of income taxes. Everybody steals. We at least admit it. Everybody else steals and lies about it. Everybody's stealing and we're doing what everybody else is doing. It's perfectly our right to steal. Says Rav Dessler, a person who grows up in a community of people, all of whom teach that it's all right to steal, is not responsible for stealing. He's not responsible. When will such a person be responsible, says Rav Dessler? When he confronts the person and says, your wallet or your life? And he says, let me think it over. Am I willing to give up my wallet to save my life? You know? And he has to decide, that, you know, every ethnic group has this joke about another ethnic group. You know, the British tell it about the Scotch, they're so cheap that, you know, they would think it over whether they're going to give up their wallet. Anyway, and this guy has to decide, shall I shoot him to take his wallet or not? This he wasn't brought up to do. He wasn't brought up to kill. He was brought up to steal. So here, he has some idea this might be wrong. And now, there could be some inner question, an inner struggle. So here, because with Dessler, already he could be responsible. But just for stealing, he's not responsible. Now, for those of you who know a little bit, stealing is considered to be a logical mitzvah. It's supposed to be something that a person can figure out all by himself. Even so, Rav Dessler says he won't be responsible. It means your logic could be corrupted. If your whole society, I'm not taking questions now, if your whole society teaches you that it's okay to steal, even though logic should be able to convince you, you're not responsible for it. Now, we're talking about homosexuality. There are whole communities of people who teach that it's perfectly all right to do this sort of thing. Okay, they live in a larger society. There is some discussion and debate. But if you shield your child from those things and bring him up with this fixed idea, that will very greatly reduce his responsibility for this crime. Because he doesn't see a real debate about the subject. He's been taught to have contempt for people who disagree with him. So that's another example of a rule that will reduce a person's responsibility. Here's another one. The Gemara says that people who don't have Torah walk around in the dark. Meaning, like when you walk in the dark, it's really dark, totally dark, you're going to bang into things. Maharal says what this means is that the only instrument, based on another Gemara as well, the only instrument with which you can fight the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination, is Torah. Now let's imagine a person who doesn't have Torah. What's he going to do? If the Gemara says in Kiddushin, the only thing, the only tool, the only weapon Gemara Kedushin says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, I created the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination, and I created the Torah to be the element that will neutralize it. No, and somebody doesn't have the neutralizing element, so he's stuck. He's stuck. Because he doesn't have the tool to fight it with. So the level of his responsibility is going to go down. Maybe it'll be even eliminated. Even though the action that he's performing is an illegal action, but the person performing it can't be expected to do better because he doesn't know any better or he doesn't have the tool to fight it. Even if he knows better, but if he doesn't have Torah, enough Torah to fight it with, so then it's like an addicted person. He's beyond responsibility. The Rambam says, everybody's judged by his actions. And what happens to him is determined by the majority of his actions. And if the majority will be bad actions, averos, transgressions, says the Rambam, miyad hu meis. He dies instantly. On this, the Ravid comments, baloney. There are lots of wicked people walking around, and they didn't die instantly. By the way, just a historical footnote, who was older, the Rambam or the Ravid?
Rambam.
Yeah, that's what everybody thinks, because the Ravid wrote a commentary on the Rambam. The truth is, the Ravid was older. The Ravid was a well-established Rosh Yeshiva in France, and when the Rambam started writing, and they circulated his writings, the Ravid said, let's see what this youngster is writing, and let's see whether it makes sense or not. People can't understand why the Ravid was so tough on the Rambam. Because he was an older, established scholar, and this youngster is writing new things that either makes sense or doesn't make sense. And here, over here, he says, lots of wicked people are walking around, and they didn't drop dead. Rambam's wrong. Kesef Mishnah says, if you read a little further in the Rambam, you'll understand what he means. A little bit further, the Rambam says, how do you calculate the majority? Not by counting up one by one. You have to weigh them. One mitzvah can count against many transgressions. One aveir, Rachman HaSlan, can count against many mitzvot. It's not the number, it's got to count the size. How big they are. How important they are. And he says, no one can do this but Hashem. Hashem is the only one who can weigh them up. So already you could have an answer to the writer. You said you see evil people walking around. That's because you're counting. But you're not weighing. And only God can weigh. And then the Rambam uses a designation for God here that I don't think he uses anywhere else. He calls God Kael Deos, the God of Deos. What does that mean? Well, Deos, in the Rambam's terminology, means personality traits. Hilchos Deos, which are right next door, talk about how to develop your character, how to develop your personality traits. So it seems what the Rambam means here is this. You look at an action, and you say, what is the legal meaning of this action? It's permitted, it's forbidden a little, it's forbidden a lot, it's a serious crime, a more serious crime. But that doesn't tell you what the action means for the person who did it. To know what it means for him, you've got to crawl inside his skull, crawl inside his heart, get into his life, and see what it looks like to him. Kael Deos. The God who knows the personality of each one, who knows each person's challenges, each person's struggles, each person's temptations, each person's strengths, and each person's weaknesses. Only he can weigh what an action means for the person who did it. And therefore, a person may look like a terrible sinner to us who are looking from the outside, and God may look on the inside and say, listen, he couldn't do much better than that. He's doing a great effort. And this is all he achieved. It's not his fault. So again, what you see is that in order to evaluate the person who performs the action, the agent, it's not enough just to look at the action. You have to look at where he's coming from. How was he brought up? How was he educated? What kind of a society did he live in? Was he subject to the Rainbow Coalition textbooks for little children in New York? where you have all types of human relationships and all types of family setups, single family and two parents of the same sex families and communal families, and they're all treated in the textbook with beautiful pictures of smiling people, and they're all happy, and that's the way the kid was brought up. What do you want from them? Finally, there are two places where Tosfos says that the rules that apply for other people, for other transgressions, crimes, and have consequences, that people lose certain rights or lose certain privileges, if the crime is a sexual crime, they don't lose. The crime could be on the same level, with the same punishment, doesn't matter. If the crime is a sexual crime, it doesn't have the same consequences. There's one place where, for certain types of crimes, a person is disqualified as a witness. We don't let him give testimony in court anymore. We don't trust him anymore. The Tosfos says, but if the crime will be a sexual crime, on the same level, we wouldn't disqualify. Why? Because a sexual crime, since the desire is so strong, a person who fails in this area, we don't say that he's totally corrupt. We don't say that he's totally criminal. We don't say that he's totally black. What we say is that in this area, he's out of control. The word Tosfos uses is ke'onus. He's like a person who's out of control. Okay, there's a ke there. It's like, not without the ke, but it means it's similar. He's similar to a person who's out of control. And therefore, we don't disqualify him for testimony. We don't say, if he performed this crime, and when he walks into court, I can't trust him to tell the truth. Because this crime would be a limited problem. A problem in one area wouldn't infect the whole of his character and lead us to think that he was a criminal personality. Similarly, if a person's in trouble, if a person is in the possibility of failing to do something right, and I can help him, I have a way to fix it so that he won't go wrong, I should do that. I should fix it even if when I fix it, I might be doing something wrong. But if what he could be doing will be worse, I should do a little wrong to prevent him from doing a big wrong. I should do that as part of my responsibility for helping him. Except if he put himself in that position on purpose. If he did it viciously, then he forfeits my help. Then I don't have to help him anymore. Only if it happens accidentally, because of lack of knowledge on his part, then I could prevent his crime by performing a smaller crime. What will be if he puts himself in that position viciously, but it's a sexual crime? So there, in a certain type of case, the Gemara says that he does not lose my support, he doesn't lose the claim on my help, and I should again do a small crime to prevent him from the larger crime. Even when he does the larger crime, he's going to do it on purpose. Not going to be by accident. But it's a sexual crime. And Tosfos again says, he's like a person who's out of control. He's not fully responsible for what he's doing. And therefore, you don't count it as rank viciousness. It isn't rank viciousness. It's like an addiction for it's out of control. So I have many reasons that reduce a person's responsibility for what he's doing. And therefore, if a person is a homosexual and even engages in homosexual actions, that does not yet tell me how I should look at him. The actions are wrong and the condition is unfortunate and dangerous, but doesn't tell me what I should say about him. He may be a pure victim. He may have very little responsibility for what he's doing, and the right relationship to him may be pity, concern, support, friendship, and an offering of help. I'll have more to say about this when I get to the end. So that's a little bit about how you look at the person. Now, let me share with you some things that the gay lobby say. To argue that homosexuality is an equally valid lifestyle. He would have outlasted. And I will show you that the arguments that they give are incorrect. Now, maybe you've heard of some that I haven't heard of. I did a survey some time ago of the literature, and this is what I came up with. If there are some that you have heard of that I haven't heard, I want to hear them, and I will try to consider them. The first thing that they'll tell you is, in 1974, a survey was done of the American Psychiatric Association. All the members of the American Psychiatric Association. And they asked them to vote. Is homosexuality an illness or not? And the majority voted no. So, the argument goes, these are the experts. These people certainly know best. They're doctors trained in psychology, and they say it's not a sickness. No, if you believe that you should live by the best opinion, the most expert opinion is telling you that it's not a sickness. So if it's not a sickness, then it's just another normal condition. And that's why we say that it's an equally valid lifestyle. Pretty persuasive, huh? American Psychiatric Association. But it's a mistake. And here's the reason it's a mistake. Because when you say that something is a sickness, you're saying it's bad. To say that something's a sickness is a moral judgment. You're saying it's bad. And when you say it's not a sickness, then you're saying it's not bad, which is also a moral judgment. Well, are psychiatrists experts in making moral judgments? I don't think so. There are people who would disqualify them altogether from making moral judgments. I wouldn't go that far. I would say that they're probably on a par with everybody else. They're human, and they have their intuitions, and they have their feelings. Nothing in the training of psychiatry makes them experts in making moral judgments. As I say, some people will say they're disqualified. It destroys their ability to make moral judgments. But there's no reason for any person to knuckle under to a moral judgment by a psychiatrist, just because he's a psychiatrist. What are they trained to do? They can tell me that these and these factors cause homosexuality, these and these factors promote it, these and these factors retard it, these and these factors eliminate it. That's what a scientist is trained to do. But to tell me whether it's good or bad, who are they to make such a judgment? So the decision that it's not a sickness is simply irrelevant. They had no business making such a decision. And therefore, there's certainly no reason to regard it as an equally valid lifestyle. It would be as if the medical profession got together and said that emphysema is not a sickness. We've decided. Nobody would pay any attention to them. It's not their job. Their job is to learn how the body works and what can make changes in the body. And people will decide what changes are valuable and people what changes are not valuable. Not up to them to decide what's valuable and what's not valuable. Now that's the first argument. The second argument has several stages. And here's how it goes. Homosexuality is a genetic condition. Since it's a genetic condition, it's impossible to change. Since it's impossible to change, you're not responsible for it. And since you're not responsible for it, it's an equally valid condition of life. Four steps. Every step is wrong. Every one of the steps is wrong. Let's go step by step. Step one. Homosexuality is a genetic condition. Here, you need to know, not only for this, but for other things as well, you need to know, when people talk about genes, there are two different things to say. And if you're doing politics, they'll be very careful not to tell you what they're saying, so that you'll end up confused and they can have you in their hip pocket. So at this point, you pull out your notes from Gottlieb's lecture and you say, wait a minute! What do you mean? Do you mean the genes determine it? Force it, cause it, make it happen? Or do you mean that the genes influence it? What do you mean? They cause it or they influence it? Here's the difference. The genes cause your eye color. You have the right kind of genes and you get brown eyes. You have the wrong kind of genes, I mean you have different genes and you get blue eyes. You know, that's how it is. The genes cause your eye color. But genes don't cause your height. You could have two parents, 7 feet tall, but if you grow up malnourished, you don't get enough to eat, you're not going to be tall. The genes don't make your height. They influence. They influence. Usually, if you have very tall parents, and you get appropriate nutrition, and you get appropriate exercise, and you don't get certain diseases, then you'll be very tall. But the genes alone don't do it. It's the genes, plus the food, plus the exercise, plus your health that do it. They're the genes influence height. They don't determine the height. Now, it's crucial to ask, when you say that homosexuality is a genetic condition, what do you mean? Do you mean the genes determine it, or the genes influence it? As I said, they'll be very careful not to discuss this with you, because if they do, the first step of the argument goes down the drain. Because no one ever claimed that the genes determine homosexuality. Even when they thought they found a gene for homosexuality, which they took back a few years ago without telling anybody. Even when they thought they found a gene, it was only a claim of influence. It was never a claim of determinism, determination. And I'll tell you why. You know what identical twins are? Identical twins means they have all the same genes. Right? That's what makes them identical. Now let's suppose you take identical twins where one twin is homosexual. If it's really genetically determined, what would you expect for the other twin? He's got to be homosexual 100% of the time. Because they have all exactly the same genes. That's what it means to be identical twins. So if one's homosexual, the other one has got to be homosexual. But it ain't so. It's 50%, not 100%. So it simply isn't true that the genes determine homosexuality. They influence it. The influence is there because in the general population, the homosexuals are about 2 or 3% of the population. And here, where one twin is a homosexual, the other twin, 50% of the time, is a homosexual. That's much bigger than 3%. But it's not 100%. So what you see is that the gene influences homosexuality, but not that it causes or determines homosexuality. Which means there have to be other factors. There have to be other factors. Something in the environment. The home life, what he eats, the kinds of sports that he does, the colors that he sees, nobody knows what it is, but it's simply not genetically determined in that way. Well, if it's not genetically determined in that way, then I have no reason to think it's unchangeable. I have no reason to think it's unchangeable. We know that something in the environment must be contributing. If something in the environment is contributing, then presumably we could do something in the environment to change it, prevent it, manipulate it. And indeed, there is evidence that certain types of therapies do help in changing sexual orientation. They help. The statistics that have been gathered recently are not 100%, but 30%, 40% can be substantially helped in changing their sexual orientation. So, to simply make a blanket statement that homosexuality is impossible to change, number one, there's no reason to say such a thing on the basis of the genes, because it's only influence. And number two, experience in therapy doesn't bear it out. I should say, just as a footnote, it is always theoretically possible that there are different complexes of genes, and in some people it's only influenced, and in some people that it's determined. It's possible, but there's no evidence for that whatsoever. So, it's a possibility, but since there's no evidence for it, the person can't use it as an argument. Now let's take the next step. Suppose, let's fantasize, suppose it were unchangeable. So the next step is, if it's unchangeable, then people aren't responsible for it. Aren't responsible for what? What do the genes do? Let's suppose we're determined. We're fantasizing now. I'm just considering the logic. That's what logicians do. They work on logic. And sometimes you have to fantasize. Suppose this were true, then what would follow? Suppose it were unchangeable, genetically determined. What's genetically determined? That on Sunday, March 3rd at 4 in the afternoon, Joe went out with Peter and... Surely the genes don't do that. At most, the genes program into the person a desire. A strong desire. They don't program into the person a specific action at a specific time. They program in a strong desire. And the person struggles with the desire and either wins the struggle or loses the struggle and acts on the desire or doesn't act on the desire. Well, let's see. How do we look at people who have strong desires and act on them? Do we say that the person who has a strong desire and the strong desire is programmed in him genetically and he acts on it is not responsible for what he does? Let's take rape. There's a good argument that lust is genetically programmed into men because that's the way your genes make more copies of themselves, you see. And if you believe in the stupid selfish gene theory, which isn't true, then you think that the genes are out to make more copies of themselves and we are just carriers to make more copies of the genes. And if you don't think that, there's a certain tendency for anything that promotes the genes to be promoted. So imagine a rapist who says, it's been genetically programmed into me to lust after women, and I am bigger and stronger than most women, and therefore, I rape them. I'm not responsible for it. What will the gay lobby say? What will the feminists say? They'll say, sir, at most, your genes program lust. They don't program rape. And your job is to control your lust. And if you don't control it, then you're responsible for the rape. Which is quite correct. What people forget is that the genes also program above the neck. Not just below the waist. The genes program your head also. Your brain. Your ability to understand what you're doing and what its consequences are. And to take measures to try to stop it. The genes work from your skull and from your scalp to your toes. Including your brain. So if they're going to say the rapist is responsible for rape, even though he has a genetically programmed lust after women, there's no reason not to say that the homosexual is responsible for his homosexual activity, even though he has a genetically programmed desire for homosexuality. Because all that could be programmed is a desire. And it isn't programmed, and it isn't determined. But even if it were, it wouldn't mean the person's not responsible for it. So that's step three. That's step three in the argument is also wrong. Can you imagine how frustrating this is to be on a campus and hear people parroting this nonsense over and over and over again and waving the flags and throwing the rotten eggs and, you know, getting very excited? And it's all nonsense. It's all nonsense. And now let's take the last step. Let's imagine, the fantasy gets bigger now. Imagine it was genetically determined, and because it's genetically determined, it's unchangeable, and because it's unchangeable, the person is not responsible. Imagine he's not responsible for it, even. Imagine the whole thing were true, even though it's all false. Imagine the whole thing were true. Would it follow that it's an equally valid lifestyle? Not at all. Let's take colorblindness. Colorblindness is totally genetically determined. And it's unchangeable. At least to date, we have no idea how to change it. And you're certainly not responsible for it. That doesn't make it equally valid. It's a tragedy. We would love to change it if we could.
If someone will discover a way to alter the genes to prevent color blindness, it will be done immediately. Why should a person suffer that way? So even if I put the first three steps together, in spite of the fact that they're all wrong, even if I put all the first three steps together, the fourth step doesn't follow. The whole thing is a mess. And as a philosopher and as a logician, it's very frustrating to see this kind of stuff parroted over and over again as if it were a gospel truth, and when it is just nonsense. This argument just, this is the most popular argument, and it's just worthless. Okay, close to, yeah. Okay, another thing that they will tell you is that homosexuality is not linked with any social dysfunction. That dysfunction there is spelled with a Y, just to make it very clever. Pretend it's Greek. It means homosexuals are not more likely to be thieves, not more likely to be murderers, not more likely to be guilty of fraud, not more likely to perform assault and battery. They're not more likely to perform any other kind of crime or be subject to any other kind of failing. So since it's not linked to any other kind of failure, why then should you be against it? Why then should you be prejudiced against it or criticize it in any way? Here there's a double mistake. I'll start with logic because that's my favorite. The argument here is not that homosexuals steal, that homosexuals kill, that homosexuals lie, that homosexuals cheat. The argument here is that homosexuality is bad. Not bad because it leads to something else that's bad. It's bad itself. So telling me that it doesn't lead to anything else is irrelevant. It would be like saying, thieves don't commit murder, so stealing is okay. I don't care about the murder. The thieving itself is bad. I don't want to go any further than that. I don't need to go any further than that. But as a matter of fact, there's plenty of evidence that at least male homosexuals have great difficulty in forming permanent attachments. Male homosexuals can have dozens of partners a year, in some cases hundreds of partners a year. Sex is something which is not part of a solid, deep, committed, lasting relationship. And in this, some psychologists feel that homosexuals are losing out. Their lives are lacking a certain quality which would make them happier, more satisfied, more fulfilling lives, and they're not capable of sustaining it because they're homosexuals. Maybe I'm just naive and I live in a sheltered world, but I was shocked to read that in certain areas in restrooms for men, the partitions between the stalls, there's a hole. And that's all you need. You don't know who he is. He doesn't know who you are. You have a hole. Just like chicken without a head. It's totally inhuman. Totally inhuman. I think that's a loss. I think that's a loss to a human being to live like that. But even if it weren't linked to that kind of failure of ability to have relationships, still, the argument here is that the homosexuality itself is bad, not that it leads to something else that's bad. Now let me tell you something that the gay lobby says. This is so widespread that it's shocking. And it is an index of how low they have sunk. They will talk to you about homophobia. Homophobia. That's supposed to be a disease. Psychological disease. And here's how it works. People who are against homosexuality, people who don't like it, condemn it, who people who criticize it, this is what makes them do it. Deep down, they sense in themselves homosexual desires. They feel a homosexual attraction. And they are horrified. They're horrified. And they are in a panic. What? Me? I have these terrible desires. I might fit into this horrible category. So they compensate for their own homosexual feelings by becoming very vicious critics and opponents of homosexuality. That's how they reassure themselves that they're not really homosexual. Anyone who says anything against homosexuals is simply a homophobe. That's what's motivating him. He's sick. I must tell you, when I grew up in the 60s and the campuses were alive with Vietnam debates and all the rest of it, this kind of remark was so low that you wouldn't even spit on it. It wasn't worthy of spitting on. Because this is not an attack on a person's arguments, not an attack on his reasoning, not an attack on his evidence, it's an attack on his personality. The correct response is, in logic, so what? So what? Let's suppose I'm motivated by homophobia. What does that have to do with my arguments? I'm presenting reasons. I'm presenting evidence. I'm presenting facts. I'm presenting arguments. Just imagine that a person is making an argument for a certain type of economics. And somebody says, but you cheat on your taxes! Would that cancel his argument about the economics? It wouldn't even be relevant. So what if he cheats on his taxes? So from jail, he'll write his economics papers and he'll change the economy. What do I care whether he is for his taxes? Your mother wears combat boots. You know, it's that kind of insult. It's lower than low to use such an insult. Now, if this appeal to your dignity doesn't help, or the person's dignity doesn't help, then try this. Let's turn it around and put it on the other foot. You know why people are homosexuals? Because they're hetero folks. That's what they are. You see, they are frightened to death of heterosexual relations. They're frightened they won't be adequate. They're frightened they won't be attractive. They're frightened that they won't be able to interest the other sex. And that's why they become homosexuals. Not because they genuinely desire it. Not because they genuinely want it. No, they're just scared to death of the opposite sex. So all homosexuals are sick. Are they going to accept that? Not on your life. Well, there's absolutely no reason to accept it the other way. That everybody who criticizes homosexuality is a homophobe. That's nonsense. Now, where does that leave us? It leaves us, I think, with the following. If a person is homosexual, that is to say, he has the desires, he has the so-called orientation, and he carries out the actions, could such a person be a Jew in good standing, a Torah Jew in good standing? Is that possible? And the answer is the Jewish answer. It depends. It depends. If the person says, I believe in God, I believe in the Torah, all 613 commandments, I believe in all of it, but I have a problem. I have a problem living up to this commandment. And I regret it, and I confess it, and I'm trying to deal with it. So far I've not been successful in dealing with it. Then it seems to me we should say to him, welcome to the club. Because every Jew is in that condition. I won't ask you to confess about your Lashon Hara. But if you're like most people, Lashon Hara is pretty common. Pretty common, pretty often, and from time to time, you take stock and say, oy vey, it's terrible, I should be more careful. And every Yom Kippur, you clap, okay, you say, I'm sorry, I've sinned, I won't do it again. And by Sukkot, you're doing it again. Right? What do we say about such people? They're not Jews in good standing. We kick them out of the community. Don't give them aliyah to the Torah. No. What we say is, he's a Jew with a problem. Every Jew has problems. Every Jew has problems. Every Jew has failures. Seems to me that a person like that, whether it's this problem or that problem, makes absolutely no difference. But if a person will say that, I believe in God, I believe in the Torah, except here. Here, the Torah went too far. After all, there are people who are born like this, and it gives you the whole shmeel that I've been through already and told you isn't valid. And he says, I wear the homosexuality for, you know, equality for homosexuals button, and I attend a homosexual synagogue, and I rabbit homosexual, and the homosexual parties, and all the rest, with filling, without filling, you know, the whole thing, right? At that point, the person should definitely be excluded from the community, because anyone who denies any element in the Torah is not part of Torah Judaism. You can't pick and choose. There are plenty of movements for people like that. And this is one of them. You can't pick and choose. So the person who can't face the fact that it's a problem, face the fact that it's a failure, and face the responsibility to do his best to overcome it, and who has to justify it, is a person who really has to be excluded from the community. A person who recognizes a problem, the very first thing he will do is he will not publicize. Just like you wouldn't wear "I speak Lashon Hara" buttons. Right? It may be true that you speak Lashon Hara, but you're not proud of it, and you're not going to advertise it. Because it's a crime. You can't be proud of a crime. And it is an equally valid lifestyle. Even if you're out of control of the way you speak, it is an equally valid lifestyle. So, if a person has the problem, but he's not affecting others, and he knows it's a problem, acknowledges the problem, and working and trying to solve it, I don't see any reason why that person can't be a full member in good standing of the Torah community. Yeah?
I don't think I understood in the beginning when you said that if someone does idol worship, the Torah says that you have to let yourself get killed as opposed to worshiping an idol. You said that. It's not like that?
No. What I said was this. You know, the Torah tells you to do lots and lots of things. Now, if you fail, there are various penalties. The penalties depend. It depends upon which particular crime it is. And sometimes they depend upon the conditions under which you perform the crime. And if the condition under which you perform the crime of idol worship is with a gun to your head, then the Torah says, die. If you don't die, that crime, the crime of worshipping the idol with a gun to your head, that crime is not punishable in court.
So technically, it's, you're not allowed to do the aver, like an elder homosexual. If you do it and you didn't have to, and it wasn't in your control, then you don't necessarily get the punishment that you're supposed to get.
That's right. That's right. Or the punishment will be drastically reduced. That's exactly right. Yeah.
In the case we said with the raping, but then the homosexual would just turn around and say, okay, but with the rape, there's no consent. But with
the
homosexual activity, it's consent on both sides, and that is legitimate lust.
The question, what you're saying is correct, but it isn't addressing the point that I was addressing. The point that I was addressing is that since it's genetically programmed, therefore I'm out of control, and therefore I'm not responsible. He's not attacking. Your remark now doesn't attack whether I'm responsible or not. Your remark attacks whether anything wrong has happened or not. That's a different consideration.
If a homosexual argues, or even a non-homosexual who just believes homosexuality is okay, says, it's not affecting you, so why should you care what I do?
Okay, I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's another element in the argument. Yeah, people should stay out of each other's lives. If what one person doesn't respond to what he said, if one person's actions affect somebody else, then the community has a legitimate interest, and you can make laws about it, but there's no business in legislating how other people behave, and it's none of your business how other people behave, and you shouldn't interfere in how other people behave. Now, I think that this attitude is grossly irresponsible. That should sound shocking. After all, that sounds so liberal. And so considerate, and so in favor of self-determination. I think it's grossly irresponsible. Let me tell you, this I saw in The Economist about 6 years ago. It's apparently the true story. It took place in England. A young man had a blood test for AIDS. And the test came back positive. Now, in the description of the test, it says, this test has 4% false positives. So he said, 4% false positives. I came back positive. So it means there's a 96% chance that I have AIDS. So he went to a store, bought a gun, and blew out his brains. killed himself. This was a great tragedy because he misunderstood the test. The true probability of his having AIDS was something like 1%. He didn't understand what 4% false positives means. And if anybody cares, when I'm finished, I'll tell you what it means. He just misunderstood it. Now, I want you to picture the following. He's walking out of the building with the paper, and you hear him mumbling to himself, 4% false positives, and I'm positive, so it's 96%. I've got AIDS. I can't face it. I'm not going to live with this. I'm not going to deteriorate, and I'm going to kill myself. And you overhear him saying this. So you say to him, hey, listen, wait. I have something important to tell you. He says, there's nothing important anymore. My life is over. You know, nothing matters anymore. He's walking into the gun shop, and you say, listen, wait, no, you've got to listen to me, because this is very important. He says, don't talk to me. My life is over. It's terrible. I'm, you know, everything's black. He's buying the gun and the bullets. And you're begging him, please, you've got to listen. This is tragic, you know. He's loading the gun. What do you do now? I think you should tie him up! Tie him up! Don't let him kill himself! He's going to kill himself for a mistake! But how could you interfere in somebody else's life? He's not doing this to anybody else. He's not killing anybody else. He's only killing himself. So who are you to interfere with his life? The answer is, he's committing a terrible tragedy, which if he just knew a little more, he wouldn't want to do. To not stop him is irresponsible. Now let's take a drug addict. This person's a drug addict. He's been through two rehabilitation programs and both failed. And he's given up. He's given up. Being an addict is terrible, he tells you, but I can't help it. I tried twice. I failed twice. You happen to know that a new therapy program has opened up for people like him. They've taken people who have failed 5 times and they've been successful. You know this. And you say to him, listen, there is hope. No, I heard that before. Don't talk to me. My life is over. He's 32. My life is over. It doesn't mean anything, you know. I heard that before. I haven't got the strength. Should you say, oh, that's your decision? Okay. Bye. You know, have a nice life, death, you know. I mean, you know, just... You know. After all, he's not hurting anybody else. He's just addicting all by himself? Or should you put pressure on him? Put pressure on him, try to persuade him, you know, put moral pressure on him and squeeze him and, you know. After all, you could save his life. Shouldn't you do something? This attitude that everybody lives his own life and nobody should interfere or judge somebody else's actions is a recipe for irresponsibility. Sometimes you know much better than the other guy what's good for him. So the question will be, do we know much better than he what's good for him or not? But no one should short circuit by saying it's private activity, and no one should judge anybody else's private activity, and everybody should leave everybody else alone. That's certainly wrong. That is that is irresponsibility, laziness, and uninvolvement masquerading as morality. It has a moral veneer, and underneath, what it really means is, you can sink to hell, and I won't bother to help you. That's not really sensitive consideration of another human being. Yeah.
So we shouldn't go by that philosophy, and to each their own?
Absolutely not. Of course not. To each their own. Or better, to each their own, when it's really their own. When it's really right for them. Not to each their own. When the alcoholic asks you for a drink, are you going to give him a drink? That's what he wants. I hope not. That's the answer over there. I think that's very important. There's a lot of this false thinking around, and some of it is anyway. And the same people who will say, with respect to homosexuality, that it's an about lifestyle, and everybody should do his own thing. When it comes to overpopulation, they're going to go around the world legislating that people can't have more children, and that free prophylactics should be available, and schooling should include classes on how to use prophylactics and why they're important, because because there are too many people, see, and therefore we want to limit the number of people. When it comes to homosexuality, then all bets are off. All hands are off. Not people. Yeah.
So what's 4% false positives?
Okay. It works like this. You give a test. Right? A blood test. The results come back. Some results are positive and some results are negative. Right? The test is not perfect. So in each class, the positive class and the negative class, you have the genuine ones and the mistakes. So really you have four categories. You have true positives and false positives, true negatives and false negatives. Right? Person tests positive. I don't care about the negatives. The negatives are irrelevant. He's in the positive class now. What I need to know is, in the positive class, how many are genuine and correct, and how many are mistaken? That way, I'll be able to say, if in the positive class, 80% are correct and 20% are wrong, then there's an 80% chance that he has the disease. If in the positive class, 5% are correct and 95% are wrong, then there's only a 5% chance of having the disease. So let's see how we figure it out. 4% false positives. How many true positives can there be? Then you'll get the total class of positives. 4% false positives, it means in the positive class, in the class of all the exams, in all the results, 4% are cases where the exam came back positive and it's wrong. Okay, how many times does the exam come back positive and it's right? Roughly, it's the percentage of people in the total population that have the disease. That would be the true positives. Well, let's see. What percentage of the people in the population have the disease? 50%? Unlikely, right? How many Brits have AIDS? 30 million? No, it doesn't sound right. That's really, I don't know, 0.5% or 0.25% or 0.1%, something like that. So what do you have? Of the 100% of tests, 4% are false positives, and 0.1% are true positives. No, so the true positives out of the total number of positives is 1% or 0.5% or something like that. It's very small. What he thought was 4% false positive leaves over 96% true positives. But he forgot that there are negatives.
Should we write those tests?
Well, you know, the article in the Economist was an article on how to teach probability. And it said that teaching of probability is so bad, most people can't understand the simplest concepts, including doctors in hospitals. They went around to hospitals and interviewed doctors and asked them simple probability questions, and they got them as wrong as the man on the street, which is really frightening because these guys are making decisions what therapy to use, and they can't figure out what the probability of success and failure is. Because they're subject to the same failures of thought and probability that the average man on the street is. That's really frightening.
That's what I have compounds.
No. Compounds don't answer problems and questions of probability. So the economist had a whole suggestion as to how probability should be taught so as to avoid. And they, in the box, it told this story as an illustration of how it can go wrong if you get probability wrong. Yeah.
How much do you know about how the AIDS virus started?
I don't know if anybody knows. I know there are about 6 different theories. And either it came from monkeys or it was mutated from another human disease. And they're all different kinds of theories. And the story they tell you today, which is very positive, is true. So next year they'll have a different story.
But like, isn't it the fact that like back in the 80s when this started becoming widespread, it was mainly in homosexuals?
It is true. It seems that homosexual activity spreads it more so than heterosexual activity, but I don't know if anybody knows why. And I don't know what it is about the practice. It could just be that they have so many more different partners that it naturally spreads, whereas in heterosexual population, the number of partners is much, much lower. So it's, of course, not going to spread that fast. I don't know. I don't know if anybody knows really what the factors are. I want to tell you one little thing which really shocked me. I'm a little behind. I got a couple of important papers this week from a friend who researches these materials. There is a movement among psychotherapists to outlaw therapy designed to change a person's sexual orientation. It means a person will come to a therapist and say, listen, I have homosexual desires, homosexual tendencies, I don't want to be like this, help me change, it'll be
against the law to help him.
Why?
This is absolutely outrageous. Here are the reasons why. Number one, since the American Psychiatric Association decided that it's not a disease, a medical profession has no business providing therapies for non-diseases. The slogan is, no disease, no cure. Is that convincing? It's dumb! Do those doctors perform therapeutic abortions? You bet they do. The woman comes in and says, I don't want to have a baby. Give me an abortion. Is she sick? Is being pregnant a disease? No, but they give her a cure, don't they? How about plastic surgery? Is being ugly a disease? Is the person sick? No! But he wants therapy for how he looks. Therapy on demand is part of the medical profession. It doesn't require a disease to justify having an expertise, a whole branch of the medical profession that performs therapy. Secondly, the second claim is that it's unchangeable. And since it's unchangeable, if you put people through therapy to change them, you're going to hurt them. You'll raise false expectations. You make them feel like failures when they don't succeed. But as a matter of fact, the evidence is against that, as I told you. The third argument was... Oh, yes, the third argument is a political argument. If you have a branch of therapy to change homosexuals into heterosexuals, you're going to make homosexuals feel bad. You're going to make them feel second class. You're going to make them feel that there's something wrong with them. Nobody said that for ugly people. And nobody said it for people who are pregnant. You know, if there's an abortion industry, it's going to make people who are pregnant feel bad. You know, if it's going to make them feel bad, so what? Should this person who wants to change be a victim for the fact that other people are going to feel bad if you help them? And in terms of positive arguments, they pointed out that people should have the right to decide for themselves how they want their lives to run. And shouldn't be told, this type of change, this type of desire, this type of aspiration is abnormal, sick, and therefore we won't help you. You have to have respect for diversity, but not only sexual diversity, what about diversity of values? What about diversity of belief, diversity of creed, diversity of religion? That's also diversity. So what are you saying? Because I want homosexuals to be respected, therefore I have no respect for your values, no respect for your beliefs, no respect for your religion. If you're in favor of diversity, then you have to have diversity both ways. There's an article which was published recently. I think it was an excellent article. I wasn't even aware of the problem. I was horrified to find people outlaw change of sexual orientation therapy. That's how far it's gone. It's totally political. It has nothing to do with medicine. It doesn't do with health. It doesn't do with improving people's lives. It's totally political. Okay.